someone sleep, and any moment now a bleary-eyed monk would come stumbling out of the dormitory, wondering whether the earthquake he had felt had been real or only a dream. Jack had set fire to the church, a heinous crime in the eyes of a monk. He had to get away quickly. He ran across the grass to the guest house. All was quiet and still. He stopped outside, panting. If he went in breathing like this, he would wake them all. He tried to control his breathing, but that seemed to make it worse. He would just have to stay here until it became normal again. A bell rang, piercing the quiet, and went on pealing urgently, an unmistakable alarm. Jack froze. If he went inside now, they would know. But if he did not? The door of the guest house opened, and Martha came out. Jack just stared at her, terrified.
"Where have you been?" she said softly. "You smell of smoke."
A plausible lie came into Jack's head.
"I've only just stepped out," he said desperately. "I heard that bell."
"Liar," Martha said. "You've been gone for ages."
"I know. I was awake."
He realized there was no fooling her.
"Was anyone else awake?" he said fearfully.
"No, only me.
Don't tell them I was gone. Please."
She heard the fear in his voice and spoke soothingly.
"All right. I'll keep it a secret. Don't worry."
"Thank you."
At that moment, Tom stepped out, scratching his head. Jack was frightened. What would Tom think?
"What's going on?" Tom said sleepily. He sniffed. "I smell smoke."
Jack pointed at the cathedral with a trembling arm.
"I think,"
he said, and then swallowed. It was going to be all right, he realized with a grateful sense of relief. Tom would just assume that Jack had got up a moment earlier, as Martha had. Jack spoke again, more confidently this time.
"Look at the church," he said to Tom. "I think it's on fire."
2. Philip had not yet got used to sleeping alone. He missed the stuffy air of the dormitory, the sound of other people shifting and snoring, the disturbance when one of the older monks got up to go to the latrine, followed usually by the other older ones, a regular procession which always amused the youngsters. Being alone did not bother Philip at nightfall, when he was always dead tired. But in the middle of the night, when he had been thoroughly roused by the service, he now found it difficult to go back to sleep. Instead of getting back into the big soft bed, it was a little embarrassing how quickly he had got used to that. He would build up the fire and read by candlelight, or kneel down and pray, or just sit thinking. He had plenty to think about. The priory's finances were worse than he had anticipated. The main reason probably was that the whole organization generated very little cash. It owned vast acreages, but many farms were let at low rents on long leases, and some of them paid rent in kind. So many sacks of flour, so many barrels of apples, so many cartloads of turnips. Those farms that were not rented out were run by monks, but they never seemed to be able to produce a surplus of food for sale. The priory's other main asset was the churches it owned, and from which it received the tithes. Unfortunately, most of these were under the control of the sacrist, and Philip was having trouble finding out exactly how much he received and how he spent it. There were no written accounts. However, it was clear that the sacrist's income was too small, or his management of it too bad, to maintain the cathedral church in good repair. Although over the years the sacrist had built up an impressive collection of jeweled vessels and ornaments. Philip could not get all the details until he had time to tour the monastery's far-flung properties, but the outline was already clear, and the old prior had for some years been borrowing from moneylenders in Winchester and London, just to meet everyday expenses. Philip had become quite depressed when he realized how bad it was. However, as he thought and prayed about it, the solution became clear. Philip had a three-stage plan. He would begin by taking control of the priory's finances personally. At present, each of the monastic officials controlled parts of the property and fulfilled his responsibility with the income from that property. The cellarer, the sacrist, the guest master, the novice master, and the infirmer all had their farms and churches. Naturally, none of them would ever confess to having too much money, and if they had any surplus, they took care to spend it, for fear that something would be taken away from them. Philip had decided to appoint a new official, called the purser, whose job it would be to receive all monies due to the priory, with no exceptions, and then give out to each official just what he needed. The purser would naturally be someone Philip trusted. His first inclination had been to give the job to Cuthbert Whitehead, the cellarer, but then he had recalled Cuthbert's aversion to writing things down. That was no good. From now on, all income and outgoings were to be written in a great book. Philip had decided to appoint the young kitchener, Brother Milius, as purser. The other monastic officials would not like the idea, no matter who got the job, but Philip was the boss, and anyway the majority of monks, who knew or suspected that the priory was in trouble, would support reforms. When he had control of the money, Philip would implement stage two of his plan. All the distant farms would be leased for cash rents. This would put an end to expensive transportation of goods across long distances. There was a property of the priories in Yorkshire that paid a rent of 12 lambs, and faithfully sent them all the way to Kingsbridge each year, even though the cost of transport was more than the value of the lambs. And anyway, half of them always died en route. In future, only the nearest farms would produce food for the priory. He also planned to change the present system, under which each farm produced a little of everything, some grain, some meat, some milk, and so on. Philip had thought for years that this was wasteful. Every farm managed to produce only enough of each item for its own needs, or perhaps it would be truer to say that every farm always managed to consume just about everything it produced. Philip wanted each farm to concentrate on one thing. All the grain would be grown in a group of villages in Somerset, where the priory also owned several mills. The lush hillsides of Wiltshire would graze cattle for butter and beef. The little cell of St. John in the Forest would breed goats and make cheese. But Philip's most important scheme was to convert all the middle-ranking farms, those with poor or indifferent soil, especially the hill properties, to sheep farming. He had spent his boyhood in a monastery that farmed sheep. Everyone farmed sheep in that part of Wales, and he had seen the price of wool rise slowly but steadily year by year ever since he could remember, right up to the present. Sheep would solve the priory's cash problem permanently in time. That was stage two of the plan. Stage three was to demolish the cathedral church and build a new one. The present church was old, ugly, and impractical, and the fact that the northwest tower had fallen down was a sign that the whole structure might be weak. Modern churches were taller, longer, and, most important, lighter. They were also designed to display the important tombs and saintly relics that pilgrims came to see. These days, more and more, cathedrals had additional small altars and special chapels dedicated to particular saints. A well-designed church that catered to the multiplying demands of today's congregations would draw many more worshippers and pilgrims than Kingsbridge could attract at the moment, and by doing so it could pay for itself in the long run. When Philip had put the priory's finances on a sound footing, he would build a new church which would symbolize the regeneration of Kingsbridge. It would be his crowning achievement. He thought he would have enough money to begin rebuilding in about 10 years' time. It was a rather daunting thought. He would be almost 40. However, within a year or so, he hoped to be able to afford a program of repairs, which would make the present building respectable, if not impressive, by the Whitsun after next. Now that he had a plan, he felt cheerful and optimistic again. Mulling over the details, he dimly heard a distant bang, like the slamming of a big door. He wondered vaguely whether someone was up and about in the dormitory or the cloisters. He supposed that if there were trouble, he would find out about it soon enough, and his thoughts drifted back to rents and tithes. Another important source of wealth for monasteries was gifts from the parents of boys who became novices, but to attract the right sort of novices, the monastery needed a flourishing school. His reflections were interrupted again, this time by a louder bang that actually made his house shake slightly. That was definitely not a door slamming, he thought. Whatever is going on over there? He went to the window and opened the shutter. The cold night blew in, making him shiver. He looked out over the church, the chapter house, the cloisters, the dormitory, and the kitchen buildings beyond. They all appeared peaceful in the moonlight. The air was so frosty that his teeth hurt when he breathed. But there was something else about the air. He sniffed. He could smell smoke. He frowned anxiously, but he could see no fire. He drew his head into the room and sniffed again, thinking that he might be smelling smoke from his own fireplace, but it was not so. Mystified and alarmed, he pulled on his boots rapidly, picked up his cloak, and ran out of the house. The smell of smoke became stronger as he hurried across the green toward the cloisters. There was no doubt that some part of the priory was on fire. His first thought was that it must be the kitchen. Nearly all fires started in kitchens. He ran through the passage between the south transept and the chapter house, and across the cloister square. In daytime he would have gone through the refectory to the kitchen courtyard, but at night it was locked, so he went out through the arch in the south walk and turned right to the back of the kitchen. There was no sign of fire here, nor in the brewery or the bakehouse, and the smell of smoke now seemed a little less. He ran a little farther and looked past the corner of the brewery, across the green to the guest house and the stables. All seemed quiet over there. Could the fire be in the dormitory? The dormitory was the only other building with a fireplace. The thought was horrifying. As he ran back into the cloisters, he had a grisly vision of all the monks in their beds, overcome by smoke, unconscious as the dormitory blazed. He ran to the dormitory door. As he reached it, it opened, and Cuthbert Whitehead stepped out, carrying a rushlight. Cuthbert said immediately, "Can you smell it?" "Yes. Are the monks all right?" "There's no fire here." Philip was relieved. At least his flock was safe. "Where then?" "What about the kitchen?" Cuthbert said. "No, I've checked." Now that he knew nobody was in danger, he began to worry about his property. He had just been thinking about finances, and he knew he could not afford repairs to buildings right now. He looked at the church. Was there a faint red glow behind the windows? Philip said, "Cuthbert, get the church key from the sacrist." Cuthbert was ahead of him. "I have it here. Good man." They hurried along the east walk to the door in the south transept. Cuthbert unlocked it hastily. As soon as the door swung open, smoke billowed out. Philip's heart missed a beat. How could his church be on fire? He stepped inside. At first, the scene was confusing. On the floor of the church, around the altar, and here in the south transept, several huge pieces of wood were burning. Where had they come from? How had they produced so much smoke? And what was the roaring noise that sounded like a much bigger fire? Cuthbert shouted, "Look up!" Philip looked up, and his questions were answered. The ceiling was blazing furiously. He stared at it, horrified. It looked like the underside of hell. Most of the painted ceiling had already gone, revealing the timber triangles of the roof blackened and blazing, the flames and smoke leaping and swirling in a fiendish dance. Philip stood still, shocked into immobility, until his neck started to hurt from looking up. Then he gathered his wits. He ran to the middle of the crossing, stood in front of the altar, and looked around the whole church. The entire roof was ablaze, from the west door to the east end and all across both transepts. For a panicky moment he thought, "How are we going to get water up there?" He imagined a line of monks running along the gallery with buckets, and he realized immediately that it was impossible. Even if he had 100 people for the job, they could not carry up to the roof a quantity of water sufficient to put out this roaring inferno. The whole roof was going to be destroyed, he realized with a sinking heart, and the rain and snow would fall into the church until he could find the money for a new roof. A crashing sound made him look up. Immediately above him, an enormous timber was moving slowly sideways. It was going to fall on top of him. He dashed back into the south transept where Cuthbert stood looking scared. A whole section of the roof, 3 triangles of beam and rafter, plus the lead sheets nailed to them, was falling in. Philip and Cuthbert watched, transfixed, quite forgetting their own safety. The roof fell on one of the big round arches of the crossing. The enormous weight of the falling wood and lead cracked the stonework of the arch with a prolonged explosive sound like thunder. Everything happened slowly. The beams fell slowly, the arch broke up slowly, and the smashed masonry fell slowly through the air. More roof beams came free, and then, with a noise like a long, slow peal of thunder, a whole section of the north wall of the chancel shuddered and slid sideways into the north transept. Philip was appalled. The sight of such a mighty building being destroyed was strangely shocking. It was like watching a mountain fall down or a river run dry. He had never really thought it could happen. He could hardly believe his eyes. It made him feel disoriented, and he did not know what to do. Cuthbert was tugging at his sleeve. "Come out!" he yelled. Philip could not tear himself away. He remembered that he had been anticipating 10 years of austerity and hard work to put the monastery back on a sound financial footing. Now, suddenly, he had to build a new roof and a new north wall, and perhaps more if the destruction went on. "This is the devil's work," he thought. "How else could the roof have caught fire on a freezing night in January?" "We'll be killed!" Cuthbert shouted, and the note of human fear in his voice touched Philip's heart. He turned away from the blaze, and they both ran out of the church into the cloisters. The monks had been alerted and were filing out of the dormitory. As they came out, they naturally wanted to stop and look at the church. Milius Kitchener was standing at the door, hurrying them along to avoid a logjam, directing them away from the church and along the south walk of the cloisters. Halfway along the walk, Tom Builder stood, telling them to turn under the arch and escape that way. Philip heard Tom saying, "Go to the guest house, stay well clear of the church." He was overreacting, Philip thought. Surely they would have been safe enough here in the cloisters. But there was no harm done, and perhaps it was a sensible precaution. In fact, he reflected, I probably should have thought of it myself. But Tom's caution made him wonder how far the destruction might spread. If the cloisters were not absolutely safe, what about the chapter house? There, in a little side room with thick stone walls and no windows, they kept the iron-bound oak chest containing what little money they had, plus the sacrist's jeweled vessels and all the priory's precious charters and deeds of ownership. A moment later he saw Alan the treasurer, a young monk who worked with the sacrist and took care of the ornaments. Philip called him. "The treasure must be taken from the chapter house. Where's the sacrist?"
"He's gone, father."
"Go and find him and get the keys and take the treasure out of the chapter house and carry it to the guest house. Run!" Alan ran off. Philip turned to Cuthbert. "You'd better make sure he does it." Cuthbert nodded and followed Alan. Philip looked back at the church. In the few moments his attention had been elsewhere, the fire had become fiercer, and now the light of the flames shone brightly in all the windows. The sacrist should have thought of the treasure instead of saving his own skin so hastily. Was there anything else that had been overlooked? Philip found it hard to think systematically when everything was happening so quickly. The monks were moving to safety. The treasury was being taken care of. He had forgotten the saint. At the far east end of the church, beyond the bishop's throne, was the stone tomb of St. Adolphus, an early English martyr. Inside the tomb was a wooden coffin containing the skeleton of the saint. Periodically, the lid of the tomb was lifted to display the coffin. Adolphus was not as popular now as he had once been, but in the old days, sick people had been miraculously cured by touching the tomb. A saint's remains could be a big attraction in a church, promoting worship and pilgrimages. They brought in so much money that, shamefully, it was not unknown for monks actually to steal holy relics from other churches. Philip had planned to revive interest in Adolphus. He had to save the skeleton. He would need help to lift the lid of the tomb and carry the coffin. The sacrist should have thought about this, too, but he was nowhere to be seen. The next monk to emerge from the dormitory was Remigius, the haughty sub-prior. He would have to do. Philip called him over and said, "Help me rescue the bones of the saint." Remigius's pale green eyes looked fearfully at the burning church, but after a moment's hesitation he followed Philip along the east walk and through the door. Philip paused inside. It was only a few moments since he had run out, but the fire had progressed very fast. There was a sting in his nostrils that reminded him of burning tar, and he realized that the roof timbers must have been coated with pitch to prevent their rotting. Despite the flames, there seemed to be a cold wind. The smoke was escaping through gaping holes in the roof, and the fire was drawing cold air into the church through the windows. The updraft fanned the blaze. Glowing embers rained down on the church floor, and several large timbers burning up in the roof looked as if they could fall at any time. Until this moment, Philip had been worried first about the monks and second about priory property, but now for the first time he was afraid for himself, and he hesitated to go farther into the inferno. The longer he waited, the greater the risk, and if he thought about it too much he would lose his nerve entirely. He hitched up the skirts of his robe, shouted, "Follow me!" and ran into the transept. He dodged around the small bonfires on the floor, expecting at any moment to be flattened by a falling roof beam. He ran with his heart in his mouth, feeling as if he wanted to scream with tension. Then, suddenly, he reached the safety of the aisle on the other side. He paused there for a moment. The aisles were stone-vaulted, and there was no fire here. Remigius was right beside him. Philip panted and coughed as smoke caught in his throat. Crossing the transept had taken only a few moments, but it had seemed longer than a midnight mass.
"We shall be killed," Remigius said.
"God will preserve us," Philip said. Then he thought, "So why am I frightened?" This was no time for theology. He went along the transept and turned the corner into the chancel, still keeping to the side aisle. He could feel the heat from the wooden stalls, which were burning merrily in the middle of the choir, and he suffered a pang of loss. The stalls had been expensively made and covered with beautiful carvings. He put them out of his mind and concentrated on the task at hand. He ran on up the chancel to the east end. The tomb of the saint was halfway across the church. It was a big stone box, standing on a low plinth. Philip and Remigius would have to raise the stone lid, put it to one side, lift the coffin out of the tomb, and carry it to the aisle, while the roof above them disintegrated. Philip looked at Remigius. The sub-prior's prominent green eyes were wide with fear. Philip concealed his own dread for Remigius's sake.
"You take that end, I'll take this," he said, pointing, and without waiting for agreement, he ran to the tomb.
Remigius followed. They stood at opposite ends and grasped the stone lid. They both heaved. The lid did not move. Philip realized he should have brought more monks. He had not paused to think. But it was too late now. If he went out and summoned more help, the transept might be impassable when he tried to return. But he could not leave the saint's remains here. A beam would fall and smash the tomb, then the wooden coffin would catch fire, and the ashes would be scattered in the wind. A dreadful sacrilege and a terrible loss to the cathedral. He had an idea. He moved around to the side of the tomb and beckoned Remigius to stand beside him. He knelt down, put both hands to the overhanging edge of the lid, and pushed up with all his might. When Remigius copied him, the lid lifted. Slowly they raised it higher. Philip had to go up on one knee, and Remigius followed suit. Then they both stood. When the lid was vertical, they gave it one more shove, and it toppled over, fell on the floor on the other side of the tomb, and cracked in two. Philip looked inside the tomb. The coffin was in good condition, its wood still apparently sound, and its iron handles only superficially tarnished. Philip stood at one end, leaned in, and grasped two handles. Remigius did the same at the other end. They lifted the coffin a few inches, but it was much heavier than Philip had expected, and after a moment Remigius let his end fall, saying, "I can't do it. I'm older than you." Philip suppressed an angry retort. The coffin was probably lined with lead, but now that they had broken the lid of the tomb, the coffin was even more vulnerable than before.
"Come here," Philip shouted to Remigius. "We'll try to stand it on end."
Remigius came around the tomb and stood beside Philip. They each took one protruding iron handle and heaved. The end came up relatively easily. They got it above the level of the top of the tomb, then they both walked forward, one on either side, raising the coffin as they went until it stood on end. They paused for a moment. Philip realized they had lifted the foot of the coffin, so the saint was now standing on his head. Philip sent him a silent apology. Small pieces of burning wood fell around them constantly. Every time a few sparks landed on Remigius's robe, he would slap at them frantically until they disappeared, and whenever he got the chance, he would steal a frightened look at the burning roof. Philip could see that the man's courage was rapidly running out. They tipped the coffin so that it was leaning against the inside of the tomb, then pushed a little more. The other end came up off the ground, and the coffin seesawed on the edge of the tomb. Then they eased it down until the other end hit the ground. They tipped it end over end once more, so that it lay on the ground the right way up. The holy bones must be rattling around in there like dice in a cup, Philip thought. This is the closest thing to sacrilege that I've ever done, but there's nothing else for it. Standing at one end of the coffin, they each took a handle, lifted, and began to drag it across the church toward the relative safety of the aisle. Its iron corners ploughed small furrows in the beaten earth. They had almost reached the aisle when a section of the roof, blazing timbers and hot lead, came crashing down right on the saint's now empty tomb. The bang was deafening, the floor trembled with the impact, and the stone tomb was smashed to smithereens. A big beam bounced onto the coffin, missing Philip and Remigius by inches and knocking the coffin out of their grasp. It was too much for Remigius. "This is the devil's work!" he shouted hysterically, and he ran away. Philip almost followed him. If the devil really were at work in here tonight, there was no telling what might happen. Philip had never seen a fiend, but he had heard plenty of tales of people who had. But monks are made to oppose Satan, not flee from him, Philip told himself sternly. He glanced longingly at the shelter of the aisle, then steeled himself, grabbed the coffin handles, and heaved. He managed to drag it out from under the fallen beam. The wood of the coffin was dented and splintered, but not actually broken, remarkably. He dragged it a little farther. A shower of small glowing embers fell around him. He glanced up at the roof. Was that a two-legged figure dancing a mocking jig up there in the flames? Or was it just a wisp of smoke? He looked down again and saw that the skirt of his robe had caught fire. He knelt down and smacked at the flames with his hands, flattening the burning fabric against the floor, and the flames died instantly. Then he heard a noise that was either the screech of tortured wood or the mad, mocking laugh of an imp. "Saint Adolphus, preserve me!" he gasped, and he took hold of the coffin handles again. Inch by inch he dragged the coffin across the ground. The devil left him alone for a moment. He did not look up, better not to gaze upon the fiend. At last he reached the shelter of the aisle and felt a little safer. His aching back forced him to stop and straighten up for a moment. It was a long way to the nearest door, which was in the south transept. He was not sure he could drag the coffin all that way before the whole roof fell in. Perhaps that was what the devil was counting on. Philip could not stop himself from looking up into the flames again. The smoky two-legged figure darted behind a blackened beam, just as Philip caught sight of it. "He knows I can't make it," Philip thought. He looked along the aisle, tempted to abandon the saint and run for his life. And there he saw, coming toward him, Brother Milius, Cuthbert Whitehead, and Tom Builder, three very corporeal forms rushing to his aid. His heart leaped for joy, and suddenly he was not sure there was a fiend in the roof at all. "Thank God," he said. "Help me with this," he added unnecessarily. Tom Builder took one swift appraising look at the burning roof. He did not appear to see any fiends, but he said, "Let's make it quick." They each took a corner and lifted the coffin onto their shoulders. It was a strain, even with four of them. Philip said, "Forward!" They walked along the aisle as fast as they could, bowed down by the heavy burden. When they reached the south transept, Tom called, "Wait!" The floor was an obstacle course of small fires, and more fragments of burning wood fell continuously. Philip peered across the gap, trying to map a route through the flames. During the few moments that they paused, a rumble began at the west end of the church. Philip looked up, full of dread. The rumble grew to a thunder. Tom Builder said enigmatically, "It's weak, like the other one." "What is?" Philip shouted. "The southwest tower."
"Oh, no."
The thunder became even louder. Philip looked horrified as the entire west end of the church seemed to move forward a yard, as if the hand of God had struck it. 10 or more yards of roof fell down into the nave with the impact of an earthquake. Then the whole of the southwest tower seemed to crumble and fall, like a landslide, into the church. Philip was paralyzed with shock. His church was disintegrating in front of his eyes. The damage would take years to repair, even if he could find the money. What would he do? How would the monastery continue? Was this the end of Kingsbridge Priory? He was jerked out of his paralysis by the movement of the coffin on his shoulder when the other three men pressed forward. Philip followed where it took him. Tom negotiated a way through the maze of fires. A burning brand fell on top of the coffin, but fortunately it slipped to the floor without touching any of them. A moment later they reached the opposite side and passed through the door, out of the church, into the cool night air. Philip was so devastated by the destruction of the church that he felt no relief at his own escape. They hurried around the cloisters to the south arch and passed through. When they were well cleared of the buildings, Tom said, "This will do." Thankfully, they lowered the coffin to the frosty ground. Philip took a few moments to catch his breath. In that pause, he realized that this was no time to act stunned. He was the prior. He was in charge here. What should he do next? It might be wise to make sure all the monks had escaped safely. He took one more deep breath, then straightened his shoulders and looked at the other men. "Cuthbert, you stay here and guard the saint's coffin," he said. "The rest of you, follow me." He led them around the back of the kitchen buildings, passed between the brewery and the mill, and crossed the green to the guest house. The monks, Tom's family, and most of the villagers were standing around in groups, talking in subdued tones and staring wide-eyed at the blazing church. Philip turned to look at it before speaking to them. The sight was painful. The entire West End was a pile of rubble, and huge flames were shooting up from what remained of the roof. He tore his gaze away. "Is everyone here?" he called out. "If you can think of anyone who is missing, call out his name." Someone said, "Cuthbert Whitehead. He's guarding the bones of the saint. Anyone else?" There was no one else. Philip said to Milius, "Count the monks to make sure. There should be 45, including you and me." Knowing he could trust Milius, he put that out of his mind and turned to Tom Builder. "Is all your family here?" Tom nodded and pointed. They were standing by the guest house wall. The woman, the grown son, and the two little ones. The small boy gave Philip a frightened look. This must be a terrifying experience for them, Philip thought. The sacrist was sitting on the iron-bound box that contained the treasure. Philip had forgotten about that. He was relieved to see it safe. He addressed the sacrist. "Brother Andrew, the coffin of St. Adolphus is behind the refectory. Take some brothers to help you and carry it." He thought for a moment. The safest place was probably the prior's residence. "Take it to my house." "To your house?" Andrew said argumentatively. "The relics should be in my care, not yours." "Then you should have rescued them from the church," Philip flared. "Do as I say without another word." The sacrist got up reluctantly, looking furious. Philip said, "Make haste, man, or I'll strip you of your office here and now." He turned his back on Andrew and spoke to Milius. "How many?"
44 plus Cuthbert, 11 novices, 5 guests, everyone is accounted for."
"That's a mercy." Philip looked at the raging fire. It seemed almost miraculous that they were all alive, and no one had even been hurt. He realized he was exhausted, but he was too worried to sit down and rest. "Is there anything else of value that we should rescue?" he said. "We have the treasure and the relics."
Alan, the young treasurer, spoke up. "What about the books?"
Philip groaned. "Of course. The books. They were kept in a locked cupboard in the east cloister, next to the door of the chapter house, where the monks could get them during study periods. It would take a dangerously long time to empty the cupboard book by book. Perhaps a few strong youngsters could pick up the whole cupboard and carry it to safety." Philip looked around. The sacrist had chosen 6 monks to deal with the coffin, and they were already making their way across the green. Now Philip selected 3 young monks and 3 of the older novices, and told them to follow him. He retraced his steps across the open space in front of the burning church. He was too tired to run. They passed between the mill and the brewery and went around the back of the kitchen and refectory. Cuthbert Whitehead and the sacrist were organizing the removal of the coffin. Philip led his group along the passage that ran between the refectory and the dormitory, and under the south archway into the cloisters. He could feel the heat of the fire. The big book cupboard had carvings on its doors depicting Moses and the tablets of stone.
Philip directed the young men to tip the cupboard forward and hoist it on their shoulders. They carried it around the cloisters to the south archway. There Philip paused and looked back while they went on. His heart filled with grief at the sight of the ruined church. There was less smoke and more flame now. Whole stretches of the roof had disappeared. As he watched, the roof over the crossing seemed to sag, and he realized it was going to go next. There was a thunderous crash, louder than anything that had gone before, and the roof of the south transept fell in. Philip felt a pain that was almost physical, as if his own body were burning. A moment later the wall of the transept seemed to bulge out over the cloisters. God help us. It's going to fall down, Philip thought. As the stonework began to crumble and scatter, he realized that it was falling toward him, and he turned to flee. But before he had taken three steps, something hit the back of his head, and he lost consciousness. For Tom, the raging fire that was destroying Kingsbridge Cathedral was a beacon of hope. He looked across the green at the huge flames that leaped high in the air from the ruins of the church, and all he could think was, "This means work." The thought had been hiding in the back of his mind ever since he had emerged, bleary-eyed, from the guest house, and seen the faint red glow in the church windows. All the time he had been hurrying the monks out of danger, and rushing into the burning church to find Prior Philip, and carrying the saint's coffin out, his heart had been bursting with shameless, happy optimism. Now that he had a moment to reflect, it occurred to him that he ought not to be happy about the burning of a church. But then, he thought, no one had been hurt, and the priory's treasure had been saved, and the church was old and crumbling anyway. So why not rejoice? The young monks came back across the green, carrying the heavy book cupboard. "All I have to do now," Tom thought, "is make sure I get the job of rebuilding this church, and the time to speak to Prior Philip about it is now." However, Philip was not with the monks carrying the book cupboard. They reached the guest house and lowered the cupboard to the ground. "Where's your prior?" Tom said to them. The eldest of them looked back in surprise. "I don't know," he said. "I thought he was behind us." Perhaps he had stayed back to watch the blaze, Tom thought, but perhaps he was in trouble. Without further ado, Tom ran across the green and around the back of the kitchen. He hoped Philip was all right, not just because Philip seemed such a good man, but because he was Jonathan's protector. Without Philip, there was no knowing what might happen to the baby. Tom found Philip in the passage between the refectory and the dormitory. To his relief, the prior was sitting upright, looking dazed but unhurt. Tom helped him to his feet. "Something hit my head," Philip said groggily. Tom looked past him. The south transept had fallen into the cloisters. "You're fortunate to be alive," Tom said. "God must have a purpose for you." Philip shook his head to clear it. "I passed out for a moment. I'm all right now. Where are the books?" "They took them to the guest house." "Let's go back there." Tom took Philip's arm as they walked. The prior was not badly hurt, but he was upset, Tom could see. By the time they got back to the guest house, the fire in the church was past its peak and the flames were dying down a little. But nevertheless, Tom could see people's faces quite clearly, and he realized with a little shock that it was daybreak. Philip started organizing things again. He told Milius Kitchener to make porridge for everyone and authorized Cuthbert Whitehead to open a barrel of strong wine to warm them up in the meantime. He ordered the fire lit in the guest house, and the older monks went in out of the cold. It started to rain, wind-driven sheets of water freezing cold, and the flames in the ruined church faded fast. When everyone was busy again, Prior Philip walked away from the guest house, on his own, and headed for the church. Tom saw him and followed. This was his chance. If he could handle this right, he could work here for years. Philip stood staring at what had been the west end of the church, shaking his head sadly at the wreckage, looking as if it were his life that was in ruins. Tom stood beside him in silence. After a while, Philip moved on, walking along the north side of the nave, through the graveyard. Tom walked with him, surveying the damage. The north wall of the nave was still standing, but the north transept and part of the north wall of the chancel had fallen.
The church still had an east end. They turned around the end and looked at the south side. Most of the south wall had come down, and the south transept had collapsed into the cloisters. The chapter house was still standing. They walked to the archway that led into the east walk of the cloisters. They were halted by the pile of rubble. It looked a mess, but Tom's trained eye could see that the cloister walks themselves were not badly damaged, just buried under the fallen ruins. He climbed over the broken stones until he could see into the church. Just behind the altar there was a semi-concealed staircase that led down into the crypt. The crypt itself was beneath the choir. Tom peered in, studying the stone floor over the crypt for signs of cracking. He could see none. There was a good chance the crypt had survived intact. He would not tell Philip yet. He would save the news for a crucial moment. Philip had walked on around the back of the dormitory. Tom hurried to catch him. They found the dormitory unmarked. Going on, they found the other monastic buildings more or less unharmed, the refectory, the kitchen, the bakehouse, and the brewery. Philip might have taken some consolation in that, but his expression remained glum. They ended up where they had started, in front of the ruined West End, having completed a full circuit of the Priory Close without speaking a word. Philip sighed heavily and broke the silence. "The devil did this," he said. Tom thought, "This is my moment." He took a deep breath and said, "It might be God's work." Philip looked up at him in surprise. "How so?" Tom said carefully, "No one has been hurt. The books, the treasure, and the bones of the saint were saved. Only the church has been destroyed. Perhaps God wanted a new church." Philip smiled skeptically. "And I suppose God wanted you to build it." He was not too stunned to see that Tom's line of thought might be self-interested. Tom stood his ground. "It may be so," he said stubbornly. "It was not the devil who sent a master builder here on the night the church burned down." Philip looked away. "Well, there will be a new church, but I don't know when. And what am I to do meanwhile? How can the life of the monastery go on? All we're here for is worship and study." Philip was deep in despair. This was the moment for Tom to offer him new hope. "My boy and I could have the cloisters cleared and ready for use in a week," he said, making his voice sound more confident than he felt. Philip was surprised. "Could you?" Then his expression changed once more, and he looked defeated again. "But what will we use for a church?" "What about the crypt?" "You can hold services there, couldn't you?" "Yes, it would do very well. I'm sure the crypt is not badly damaged," Tom said. It was almost true. He was almost sure. Philip was looking at him as if he were the angel of mercy. "It won't take long to clear a path through the debris from the cloisters to the crypt stairs," Tom went on. "Most of the church on that side has been completely destroyed, which is fortunate, oddly enough, because it means there's no further danger from falling masonry. I'd have to survey the walls that are still standing, and it might be necessary to shore some of them up. Then they should be checked every day for cracks, and even so you ought not to enter the church in a gale." All of this was important, but Tom could see that Philip was not taking it in. What Philip wanted from Tom now was positive news, something to lift his spirits. And the way to get hired was to give him what he wanted. Tom changed his tone. "With some of your younger monks laboring for me, I could fix things up so that you're able to resume normal monastic life, after a fashion, within 2 weeks." Philip was staring at him. 2 weeks? "Give me food and lodging for my family, and you can pay my wages when you have the money." "You could give me back my priory in 2 weeks?" Philip repeated incredulously. Tom was not sure he could, but if it took 3, no one would die of it. 2 weeks, he said firmly. "After that, we can knock down the remaining walls. That's a skilled job, mind you, if it's to be done safely. Then clear the rubble, stacking the stones for reuse. Meanwhile, we can plan the new cathedral." Tom held his breath. He had done his best. Surely Philip would hire him now. Philip nodded, smiling for the first time. "I think God did send you," he said. "Let's have some breakfast. Then we can start work."
Tom breathed a shaky sigh of relief. "Thank you," he said. There was a quaver in his voice that he could not quite control. But suddenly he did not care, and with a barely suppressed sob he said, "I can't tell you how much it means to me." After breakfast, Philip held an impromptu chapter in Cuthbert's storeroom beneath the kitchen. The monks were nervously excited. They were men who had chosen or had reconciled themselves to a life of security, predictability, and tedium, and most of them were badly disoriented. Their bewilderment touched Philip's heart. He felt more than ever like a shepherd, whose job it is to care for foolish and helpless creatures. Except that these were not dumb animals. They were his brothers, and he loved them. The way to comfort them, he had decided, was to tell them what was going to happen, use up their nervous energy in hard work, and return to a semblance of normal routine as soon as possible. Despite the unusual surroundings, Philip did not abbreviate the ritual of chapter. He ordered the reading of the martyrology for the day, followed by the memorial prayers. This was what monasteries were for. Prayer was the justification of their existence. Nevertheless, some of the monks were restive, so he chose chapter 20 of St. Benedict's Rule, the section called On Reverence at Prayer. The necrology followed. The familiar ritual calmed their nerves, and he noticed that the scared look was slowly leaving the faces around him, as the monks realized that their world was not coming to an end after all. At the end, Philip rose to address them. "The catastrophe that struck us last night is, after all, only physical," he began, putting into his voice as much warmth and reassurance as he could. "Our life is spiritual. Our work is prayer, worship, and contemplation." He looked all around the room for a moment, catching as many eyes as he could, making sure he had their concentrated attention. Then he said, "We will resume that work within a few days. That I promise you." He paused to let those words sink in, and the easing of tension in the room was almost tangible. He gave them a moment, then went on. "God, in his wisdom, sent us a master builder yesterday to help us through this crisis. He has assured me that if we work under his direction, we can have the cloisters ready for normal use within a week." There was a subdued murmur of pleased surprise. "I'm afraid our church will never be used for services again. It will have to be built anew, and that will take many years, of course. However, Tom Builder believes the crypt to be undamaged. The crypt is consecrated, so we can hold services there. Tom says he can make it safe within a week after finishing the cloisters. So you see, we can resume normal worship in time for Quinquagesima Sunday." Once again, their relief was audible. Philip saw that he had succeeded in soothing and reassuring them. At the beginning of this chapter, they had been frightened and confused. Now they were calm and hopeful. Philip added, "Brothers who feel themselves too frail to undertake physical labor will be excused. Brothers who work all day with Tom Builder will be allowed red meat and wine." Philip sat down. Remigius was the first to speak. "How much will we have to pay this builder?" he asked suspiciously. You could trust Remigius to try to find fault. "Nothing yet," Philip replied. "Tom knows our poverty. He will work for food and lodging for himself and his family until we can afford his wages." That was ambiguous, Philip realized. It might mean that Tom would not be entitled to wages until the priory could afford it, whereas the reality was that the priory would owe him wages for every day he worked, starting today. But before Philip could clarify the agreement, Remigius spoke again. "And where will they lodge?" "I have given them the guest house." "They could lodge with one of the village families." "Tom has made us a generous offer," Philip said impatiently. "We're fortunate to have him. I don't want to make him sleep crowded in with someone's goats and pigs when we have a decent house standing empty."
"There are two women in that family."
"A woman and a girl," Philip corrected him.
"One woman, then. We don't want a woman living in the priory."
The monks muttered restively. They did not like Remigius's quibbling. Philip said, "It's perfectly normal for women to stay in the guest house."
"Not that woman," Remigius blurted.
Then he immediately looked as if he regretted it. Philip frowned.
"Do you know the woman, brother?"
"She once inhabited these parts," Remigius said reluctantly. Philip was intrigued. It was the second time something of this sort had happened in connection with the builder's wife. Walleran Bygod had also been disturbed by the sight of her. Philip said, "What's wrong with her?" Before Remigius could answer, Brother Paul, the old monk who kept the bridge, spoke up.
"I remember," he said rather dreamily, "there was a wild forest girl used to live around here. Oh, it must be 15 years ago. That's who she reminds me of. Probably it's the same girl grown up."
"People said she was a witch," Remigius said. "We can't have a witch living in the priory."
"I don't know about that," said Brother Paul in the same slow, meditative voice. "Any woman who lives wild gets called a witch sooner or later. People saying a thing doesn't make it so. I'm content to leave it to Prior Philip to judge in his wisdom whether she's a danger."
"Wisdom doesn't come immediately with the assumption of monastic office," Remigius snapped.
"Indeed not," said Brother Paul slowly.
He looked directly at Remigius and said,
"Sometimes it doesn't come at all."
The monks laughed at that riposte, which was all the funnier for coming from an unexpected source. Philip had to pretend to be displeased. He clapped his hands for silence.
"Enough," he said. "These matters are solemn. I will question the woman. Now let us go about our duties. Those who wish to be excused from labour may retire to the infirmary for prayer and meditation. The rest, follow me."
He left the storeroom and walked around the back of the kitchen buildings to the south archway which led into the cloisters. A few monks left the group and headed for the infirmary, among them Remigius and Andrew Sacrist. There was nothing frail about either of them, Philip thought, but they would probably cause trouble if they joined the labour force, so he was happy to see them go. Most of the monks followed Philip. Tom had already marshalled the priory servants and started work. He stood on the pile of rubble in the cloister square, with a large piece of chalk in his hand, marking stones with the letter T, his initial. For the first time ever, it occurred to Philip to wonder how such large stones could be moved. They were certainly too big for a man to lift. He saw the answer immediately. A pair of poles were laid side by side on the ground, and a stone was rolled along until it rested across the poles. Then two people would take the ends of the poles and lift. Tom Builder must have shown them how to do that. The work was proceeding rapidly, with most of the priory's 60 servants helping, making a stream of people carrying stones away and coming back for more. The sight lifted Philip's spirits, and he gave up a silent prayer of thanks for Tom Builder. Tom saw him and came down off the pile. Before speaking to Philip, he addressed one of the servants, the tailor who sewed the monk's clothes.
"Start the monks carrying stones," he instructed the man. "Make sure they take only the stones I've marked, otherwise the pile may slip and kill someone."
He turned to Philip. "I've marked enough to keep them going for a while."
"Where are they taking the stones?" Philip asked.
"Come and I'll show you. I want to check that they're stacking them properly." Philip went with Tom. The stones were being taken to the east side of the priory close. "Some of the servants will still have to do their normal duties," Philip said as they walked. "The stable hands must still care for the horses. The cooks have to prepare meals. Someone must fetch firewood and feed the chickens and go to market. But they're none of them overworked, and I can spare half of them. In addition, you'll have about 30 monks."
Tom nodded. "That'll do."
They passed the east end of the church. The labourers were stacking the still warm stones up against the east wall of the priory close, a few yards from the infirmary and the prior's house. Tom said, "The old stones must be saved for the new church. They won't be used for walls because second-hand stones don't weather well, but they'll do for foundations. All the broken stones must be kept too. They'll be mixed with mortar and poured into the cavity between the inner and outer skins of the new walls, forming the rubble core."
"I see."
Philip watched while Tom instructed the workers how to stack stones in an interlocking pattern so that the pile would not topple. It was already clear that Tom's expertise was indispensable. When Tom was satisfied, Philip took his arm and led him on around the church to the graveyard on the north side. The rain had stopped, but the gravestones were still wet. Monks were buried at the east end of the graveyard, villagers at the west end. The dividing line was the out-jutting north transept of the church, now in ruins. Philip and Tom stopped in front of it. A weak sun broke through the clouds. There was nothing sinister about the blackened timbers in daylight, and Philip felt almost ashamed that he had thought he had seen a devil last night. He said, "Some of the monks are uneasy about having a woman live within the precincts of the priory." The look that came over Tom's face was more intense than anxiety. He seemed scared, even panicked. "He really loves her," Philip thought. He went on hastily, "But I don't want you to have to live in the village and share a hovel with another family. To avoid trouble, it would be wise for your wife to be circumspect. Tell her to stay away from the monks as much as possible, especially the young ones. She should keep her face covered if she has to walk about the priory. Most of all, she mustn't do anything which could incur the suspicion of witchcraft." "It shall be done," said Tom. There was a note of determination in his voice, and he looked a little daunted. Philip recalled that the wife was a sharp-witted woman with a mind of her own. She might not take kindly to being told to make herself inconspicuous. However, her family had been destitute yesterday, so she was likely to see these restraints as a small price to pay for shelter and security. They walked on. Last night Philip had seen all this destruction as a supernatural tragedy, a terrible defeat for the forces of civilization and true religion, a body blow to his life's work. Now it just seemed like a problem he had to solve. Formidable, yes, even daunting, but not superhuman. The change was mainly due to Tom. Philip felt very grateful to him. They reached the West End. Philip saw a fast horse being saddled at the stable and wondered who was going on a journey today of all days. He left Tom to return to the cloisters while he himself went over to the stable to investigate. One of the sacrist's helpers had ordered the horse, young Alan, who had rescued the treasure chest from the chapter house. "And where are you off to, my son?" said Philip. "To the bishop's palace," Alan replied. "Brother Andrew has sent me to fetch candles, holy water, and the host, as we lost all those things in the fire, and we are to have services again as soon as possible." That made sense. All such supplies had been kept in a locked box in the choir, and the box was sure to have been burned. Philip was glad the sacrist was well organized for a change. "That's good," he said. "But wait a while. If you're going to the palace, you can take a letter from me to Bishop Walleran." Sly Walleran Bygod was now bishop-elect, thanks to some rather disreputable maneuvering. But Philip could not now withdraw his support, and was obliged to treat Walleran as his bishop. "I ought to give him a report on the fire."
"Yes, father," Alan replied. "But I already have a letter to the bishop from Remigius."
"Oh." Philip was surprised. That was very enterprising of Remigius, he thought. "All right," he said to Alan. "Travel cautiously, and may God go with you."
"Thank you, father."
Philip walked back toward the church. Remigius had been very quick off the mark. Why had he and the sacrist been in such a hurry? It was enough to make Philip a little uneasy. Was the letter just about the burning of the church, or was there something else in it? Philip stopped halfway across the green and turned to look back. He would be perfectly within his rights to take the letter from Alan and read it. But he was too late. Alan was trotting through the gate. Philip stared after him, feeling mildly frustrated. At that moment, Tom's wife stepped out of the guest house carrying a scuttle which presumably contained ashes from the fireplace. She turned toward the dunghill near the stable. Philip watched her. The way she walked was pleasing, like the gait of a good horse. He thought again about Remigius's letter to Walleran. Somehow he could not shake off an intuitive but nonetheless worrying suspicion that the main burden of the message was not, in fact, the fire. For no very good reason, he felt sure the letter was about the stonemason's wife. 3. Jack woke up at first cockcrow. He opened his eyes and saw Tom getting up. He lay still and listened to Tom pissing on the ground outside the door. He longed to move to the warm place Tom had vacated and cuddle up to his mother, but he knew Alfred would mock him mercilessly if he did, so he stayed where he was. Tom came back in and shook Alfred awake. Tom and Alfred drank the ale remaining from last night's dinner.